Hi, I'm Nick Rigoretti's, and this is the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast, the show for grapplers and martial artists that want to evolve both on and off the mat.
Welcome back to the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast. I apologize about not having an episode last week. I had something really cool for you guys, and we had a technical difficulty, and we lost the files. But I got the guest back. The guest is Liam Reznikov, who is, I can say without reservation, one of the most authentic people in Jiu-Jitsu. That's a very important word to me, authentic. I believe authenticity is something that's in very short supply in the modern world, and it's always refreshing when I meet someone who has it in abundance, just like Liam does. This is a pretty powerful conversation about the nature of the Jiu-Jitsu world, or the current nature of the Jiu-Jitsu world, and why there are some pretty healthy things about it, but also some pretty unhealthy things about it. So without further ado, here is episode 7 of the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast. Everyone, welcome back to the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast. This is episode 7. It's actually episode 7.5 because I recorded this last week and we had a technical issue. We had a fantastic chat and I was so pumped about it, so pumped to send it out to you guys. And then when I checked the file, it wasn't working. So we had to do it again. And that's why there wasn't a podcast last week.
In other words, I didn't push record. Yeah.
No one's taking blame. No one's pointing fingers.
Yeah.
But this week, I'm with my good friend, Liam Reznikov. One of the reasons I wanted you guys to hear from him is because he's one of the smartest guys I've met on my jiu-jitsu journey. I just love the way he thinks. I love the way he takes everything, I don't want to say seriously, but he analyzes everything to such a high level. And he's just a genuine all-around good dude and the kind of person I think we need more of in jiu-jitsu. So as I said, we recorded this already, but we have so much to talk about every time Liam and I chat that I don't think we'll have to rehash or repeat anything this time, will we, Liam?
I had that concern, and I thought to myself, last time I saw you in person was in LA. I met you for breakfast, and when it was hitting dinner, we were still talking, and I said, "Dude, I think I gotta go." So
that was cool.
I don't think it's gonna be a problem, but you know, man, I hope we do cover some of the same topics, because I remember we finished the last podcast with, you said people are going to be out for blood after hearing this, and that's the kind of podcast it was. So it was pretty interesting. I thought that was a nice way to end it. It was also a good way to start it maybe this time.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, so we're going to have to cover that part again. I think the best way that the story that you told can be encapsulated is with the way it ended. And the way it ended was you sitting facing Hoyle Gracie.
Oh, yeah.
And him saying to you, "Liam, you are no longer representative of the Gracie family."
Oh, dude, those words.
So I think they cut you deep. Huh?
Well, it's funny because I didn't realize I was a representative of the Gracie family. And I thought to myself, man, I would have been going around town abusing that power if I knew I had the sheriff's badge. But I guess you only find out too late, right?
Yeah, well, let's go film noir in this, and we've started at the end. Take us back to the beginning. How did you find yourself
film noir
at the point? Yeah, I knew you would. How did you find yourself at the point where you're sitting in Australia opposite Hoyle Gracie and he's dropping this bomb on you?
Yeah.
Can you get us to that point?
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing is, last time we spoke about it, we got there, you know, in sort of like a roundabout organic way. But I mean, the bottom line was, you know, I started originally with the Carlson Gracie side of jiu-jitsu, you know, Laborio and those guys. And, you know, my coach left, went back to Brazil, and it was, actually he went to America, and like they tend to. You know, I don't know if England was the same, but back in kind of like the Wild West of Australian Jiu-Jitsu, it was, you know, you'd have a guy there, you know, you'd start training with him, and 2 years in, his visa would run out, or he'd go to, like, you know, the Golden Land, America, to teach, and you'd just switch affiliations, but you never moved. You just sat in the same school. And, you know, a lot of schools went through, you know, 3 or 4 affiliations before they kind of settled, and none of which by choice, you know. So so my second, our second affiliation was a man named Bruno Pano, who was under Hoyler Gracie. And, you know, I was of the opinion at the time that all jiu-jitsu is equal. And, you know, what I found out was it's not. The Gracie side, like the Elio Gracie side, they genuinely have a style that is actually quite unique. And I guess, you know, I'd heard about it and I thought about, oh, maybe it's just BS and stuff. But no, they actually do have a very unique style. And I think, you know, it's with Hodger. Actually, Hodger won on the weekend, and that was between the last time we talked and now. And which we should talk about at some stage, but it seems like there's this kind of like return to that Gracie style now, which is quite interesting. But, you know, so basically 15, that was in 2001, and I was with the Hoyler Gracie side of jiu-jitsu for about 16 years, and I was with the Carlson Gracie side for about 3 years and a bit before that. And I just... You know, a lot of things happen over 16 years, man. And you know, when you sign up to an affiliation, you don't realize when you leave that you're not just leaving, you know, the name or the badge. You're actually leaving your friends, your coaches, your mentors. It was a really big turning point in my life. We talked about it before, and I'm trying to describe it authentically, I guess, but without. Remembering how I told you last time, but, you know, basically, when you're breaking up with a girl, you carry this sort of weight on your shoulder, or a guy, you carry this sort of weight on your shoulder where you just know you're kind of heading to that end point, and you wake up every morning, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. You're old enough to have, I'm sure, been in more than one relationship, and you just carry this thing around with you, and you don't even know what's actually wrong at the time. And then, you know, one day we had a 10-day self-defense course, and I went for the first day, and I was just convincing myself to get pumped and just get through this, and, you know, da-da-da-da. And on the second day, I actually woke up in the morning crying, and I mean, it wasn't crying as much as, like, weeping. I don't know how else to describe it, you know, it was out of my control. You know, my wife was pregnant at the time, and she was unwell. And, you know, I called Hoyler, and I called my coach Bruno at the time, and I said, guys, you know, I'm not going to be able to make it in today. You know, my wife's unwell, which was actually true. But I was also, for some reason, I didn't understand why I was so emotional. And, you know, my coach picked up the phone, and the first thing he said was, don't worry about the course. You know, he did the right thing. And, you know, can I help you? Is there anything I can do? Take care of your family. So, you know, that was nice. And, you know, I settled down a bit that day. And the next day I went in, and I was going to, you know, pluck it up and just do the third day of the course and just get through 10 days of the self-defense course. And, man, I went in and I just sat in the car crying again. And I was like, you know, I don't have any claim to machismo, but
not after that anyway.
No, but you know, man, I think, like, in a Latin American sense, that's not like they understand that sort of that emotion is manly in a way, but that's a different topic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a totally different topic. I wasn't embarrassed to be crying. I went inside and I said, Hoyler and Bruno, do you guys mind if I sit down with you guys quietly? And, you know, they could see I was quite upset. And to be honest, at that stage, I'd probably annoyed them quite a lot, man, because I appeared to be kind of a bit of a thorn in their side, you know, like resisting a little bit here and resisting a bit there. Well, it wasn't actually my intention. Mm-hmm. And I sat them down, and I just went to sit them down just to tell them, you know, what I'm going through. But, you know, as you do when you get to that stage, you know, and it's happened to me with girls in the past, it's like you take one step and next thing you're 20 steps down the path and you're breaking up. And you know, I sat down, man. It must have been pretty hard for Hoyler to have this man in front of him crying. I don't know. He wasn't unkind, you know. He's a very nice man. And I just man, I didn't know what to do. And my coach, you know, he was trying to hold back tears, I guess, because I think he realized at the time that this was probably going to be the last time we're, you know, together. I know it sounds weird, but man, you know, 15, 16 years, you know, I fought for the team. He, you know, did a lot. He moved countries, you know, just to teach me and a handful of guys. So it was a big deal. And, you know, it was a long time coming, man. And, you know, the next day Hoyler called me and he just said, Liam, you know, very nice, man, was never unprofessional about it. He says, look, you don't believe in what I do. And I, you know, because I voiced, unfortunately, that, you know, we had philosophical and technical sort of, I guess, paths that were different. And I'll explain more on that in a second. But and he just said, Liam, you're no longer a Gracie family representative. Now, he was very nice and stuff. And I said, you know, can I still have, you know, my coach as my mentor at the time. I was a bit, you know, man, I was a bit emotional. I was a bit lost. I didn't really know what to say to that. I was kind of clinging on to what I was, you know, used to. And he says, look, I you can try, man, but I don't think he's going to be able to. And, you know, my coach took me aside and he said, look, man, you know, you know, you've always been my friend and, you know, I'm always here for you. And me and him still speak and stuff, but it was sad, man, because I realized that's the last time he's going to be above me, you know. And it was by and large the most important decision of my life, in terms of jiu-jitsu, but maybe in terms of, you know, many other things. But yeah, I mean, it was, I walked into my academy and I made a little announcement. I thought my students would be upset, and they said to me, dude, we've been waiting for you to do this for 5-10 years. Like we knew you were unhappy, you know. we just wanted to support you. We just wanted to do what you thought was right, you know. And I, the whole time I thought that I was doing what's right because that's what they wanted, you know. They wanted to be under the Gracies or something, I don't know.
I guess what interests me most, and I think this is probably the part where you're going to have to be most honest, and I'd appreciate it if you didn't sugarcoat it.
I think past
it,
the crying part, I don't think I could be any more honest.
Well, I guess, why did you feel this philosophical disconnect, or why did you feel that you could no longer like continue being part of that association?
Well, you know, it wasn't the association as such. It was, I mean, this is something I mean genuinely. I feel like I had to leave the Gracie family to continue their work. You know, to continue the work that got me hooked in the first place, that got me believing in jiu-jitsu. My parents are karate teachers, and I remember the exact same thing happening in their organizations. There's a certain point where people start going back into the past and go back to look for secrets rather than moving forward. And it's I don't consider myself a fighter. You know, I competed a lot, but I consider myself, and I want to be an artist. And I think, you know, there's a point where you drain yourself to where there's nothing left in the reservoir, and you just like want to be surrounded by, I guess, the kind of thinkers that make you feel inspired and are inspired by you. And I guess, you know, the big thing with the Carlson Gracie side was that it was all about fighting, but it was also about innovation. Especially like I spent a lot of time with BTT when they were in the Pride days, and man, the innovation in that academy in the tennis club, every day Zamari would come in with new things, and Palofilio would show you this, and Minotaur, and this guy would come in, and there was a new armbar setup, and oh, what if Anderson Silva does this? What do we do to fight that? And man, I felt really alive, you know. And you know, like everybody else who's a jiu-jitsu coach, this isn't my first profession. I gave up advertising and chiropractics and a film career to pursue this. So, you know, my main goal in life has always been to kind of create and be part of creation. And I just got to a stage where we were doing things that were 40, 50 years old that weren't true to what I thought were... You know, like the jiu-jitsu split into two different schools, self-defense and sport. But the strange thing is, it's exactly like politics. The left wing and the right wing are pretty much the same thing. They're people who are dogmatically doing the same thing, And, you know, the sports side are obsessed with drilling, and the self-defense side are obsessed with drilling. There's no concept of creativity and aliveness on either side. It's just do what I say, do it now, do lots of it, and it'll be muscle memory. And as a black belt, I didn't have a place in the history of jiu-jitsu and the creation side of jiu-jitsu. And I thought, what am I doing this for, man? You know, like at the end of the day, I wake up every morning, and I've given up other careers, and I'm happy I did. But I'm here to help make a mark and give back, and I just wasn't giving back. And I had years of that where I just woke up going, is this it?
Yeah, I get that.
You know, I don't know how else to say it, man. You know.
Yeah, it's. I really do understand what you're speaking about. I really do, but. Also, you know, we walk a tightrope, because on the one side, you have to be innovating and pushing and driving forwards to feel alive.
Mm.
But on the other side, man, you look at Hodja, bro, look what he just did. And that's not super, super cutting edge stuff. He's using like...
I totally disagree with that, sir. I think he's miles and years ahead of... a lot of people, and I'll tell you what I mean, because I get what you're saying. And what's, you know, man, I almost want to hate on Hodja, not as a person. I know he's a very kind person, but the people that are using his example to justify their style of jiu-jitsu, which is not what he's doing, is starting to really bug me. I'm watching it. I mean, look, everybody's got something to sell at the end of the day. And I'm watching everybody who used to criticize Hodja jump on the Hodja bandwagon, because he's now proven that the IBJJF sports roly-poly system is nonsense. I mean, look, dude, for no offense, it could have been a fluke, but I don't think it was. But I just mean as in, like, it was one match. But the whole jiu-jitsu world has now used it to confabulate some sort of, you know, philosophy that suits them. And it's, I think what Hodja's doing is cutting-edge stuff, man. Mm-hmm. But it's
you make a good point.
Cutting edge. Oh, it's what, you know, like, I mean, does Hodja drill? You've trained with him. How much drilling does Hodja really do?
I mean, he doesn't do any except specific sparring, which is, I guess, a drill in and of itself. So sparring from specific positions.
Specific sparring is like me giving you a camera and saying, make me a 5-minute video. The topic is pineapples. And you can go away and make any video you want. It's not the same as me going, here's a script, Nick, go film my script on pineapples. And that, to me, is what self-defense and drilling is. Whereas Hodja seems to have, he's brilliant and he's cutting edges in those little nuances of the fundamentals, that the only way you can get good at that is by doing specific sparring over and over again and applying your own genius to it. So I think he is, and I know that's how you teach, so it's not something strange to you, but I think he's cutting edge, man. I look at Kron, I think Kron's cutting edge, and you know, I think Andre Galval's cutting edge, but I don't know if his environment is cutting edge.
You're talking about Atos.
It doesn't encourage... Well, I don't think it encourages heuristic learning, you know, like helping students solve their own problems. That's kind of where the left and the right, you know, the self-defense are on the right and the sport are on the left. They're so extreme that all they do is hand me down techniques and secrets and make you drill them. They're doing the same thing to each other. It just wasn't for me. And it's not for my students, you know, at the end of the day.
There's something else I wanted to discuss.
Yeah, I got carried away on that. Sorry.
No, it's cool.
It is also midnight almost here, and my kids have been crying, so excuse me. I just taught like 5 hours, so I'm not in my sharpest.
Okay, can you stop making excuses, please, Liam?
Okay, I'm crying right now.
Buddy, you said something during our first conversation. You captured a very... I thought you put something in a very intelligent way. You were speaking about how jiu-jitsu kind of allows people who have never experienced non-intimate physical contact to experience it. Could you just expand a little bit upon that, because I was fascinated by the way you broke it down.
You know, man, unfortunately with this conversation, it's ended up me just talking, because our last conversation was such a wonderful back and forth. So, and I'm happy to do that. I just, it, it's just less organic than it was. It was last time both of us dug to find that spot as opposed to me just talking. But, you know, look, I mean, I came from a very stoic background. I'm South African like you. My dad was a military guy. You know, his parents and grandparents were, you know, Europeans escaping the war, and the concept of cuddling and hugging just wasn't something that I grew up with. And you know, my first judo coach was a guy who was an Irish guy. He was a lovely guy, very confident, and he used to like talk to me with his hand on my shoulder, and I was very uncomfortable with that for a long time. And I realized that what grappling really brings, like it brings, is this connection to this silent language between two people, and it's non-intimate contact. You know, of course we grow up, we have girlfriends, we have intimate contact, but non-intimate contact is just, I mean, you know, I live in an apartment block where my neighbors don't even know my name. You know, as they walk towards me, a force field of a meter bounces off it. You know, we play like slalom with each other, you know, just in case my elbow bumps their elbow, you know, and we apologize, you know, profusely for any physical contact. And I just think that one of the things I noticed about jiu-jitsu, which is wonderful, is when a new person comes to the academy, you know, they're often very stiff and rigid and uncomfortable in their own skin, and by no actual design process, it's just what it is. You know, a year later, they're talking to someone with their hand on their shoulder, and you know, their legs touching another person's leg, and they're completely comfortable with that. You know, there's no apologies for being a puppy dog, you know, playing with other puppy dogs. And it's just, I think there's got to be some sort of underlying lack of lights that just don't switch on in our normal society, that, you know, they switch on when you're become comfortable with that sort of thing. I mean, we spoke about it, and you said, you know, you grew up with hugs, and, you know, that's, unfortunately, not everyone else's experience, you know. And I live in a, it's just, sorry to keep going on this, but, you know, I live in an area that's very much an Asian area, particularly Chinese, Hong Kong Chinese area. And this is just stereotyping, but, you know, like their family comes, you know, a lot of their families come from very strict backgrounds where the parents are very kind, but they don't, you know, they don't hug, and, you know, they're not soft towards the children. And I see what happens when they come in, and a year later, that they actually, they move differently, they walk, they swagger in a different way that's just, I don't know, man, it's like a sort of coming of age, I suppose, that it just doesn't happen outside of jiu-jitsu.
There's an expression which, you know, there's a lot of things you hear as a kid, and you don't really, you just understand them on a very surface level, and, or you just think it's a boring old, a figure of speech that's just been used forever. One of them is
and old now.
comfortable in his own skin, and I never really knew what that meant until I met people who weren't comfortable in their own skin. You know, people. Right. My buddy says it. We watched a documentary on cults together, and he said,
"It's my favorite."
Yeah, it's really good. He said, it was something like, I think it was the Heaven's Gate cult. It was like 30 people there. And he said, when you watch the interviews with these people, before they died, they recorded interviews. He said, one of the things that you see is, he can say without question, every single one of these people, it never looks like any of them reached a point in their lives where they were like, this is me. I'm a human being. I'm in a body. I'm comfortable, and I'm here enjoying this experience. And I think that, is that the kind of thing you're talking about? Like, you see guys who come and they're kind of like, they're almost like wearing a body suit or shell, instead of like, they haven't really like synced up with their physicality.
It's like that Donnie, sense. You know, that Donnie Darko line in the cinema, what are you wearing that rabbit suit for? And the rabbit turns to him and he's like, what are you wearing that man suit for?
Yeah.
You know, man, it's, and I think, man, you know, when you watch those Heaven's Gate cult things, you know, you're seeing people that are very susceptible, and the ability to manipulate them by their, you know, obviously sociopathic, you know, leaders is probably a lot simpler than we think. They just put their hand on their shoulder and look into their eyes. And you know, I hear cult leaders tend to not blink, you know. I mean, you can watch Anthony Robbins if you like. Have you seen I'm Not Your Guru? And then he spends the next hour and a half presenting himself as a guru. That is a terrifying documentary.
Well, just horror so film. You know, that horror film was... I haven't watched it, but
you must.
I have no interest in watching it because it was created by one of his acolytes.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah. Which I didn't know, and I researched it subsequently.
Oh, dude.
And I'm actually at this point now with a lot of that stuff. Funny you mentioned Anthony Robbins because I used to really look up to that guy. I used to think that he was
he's 7 foot
good
tall
human being. Yeah, well, yeah, I did. Literally. But there came a point. It was about 10 days ago. I don't know why, but I was researching a little bit more, and I came upon a few articles just describing him and the way he does things, and I just realized that, man, he's just someone that knows more about human psychology and physiology and sociology, and he knows the specific triggers to press to get people to respond to him in a certain way. And what he's doing is he is priming them through a bunch of verbal and physical cues and getting them to almost like imprint on him. And my sister's boyfriend, he's a huge fan. And
Jesus. Yeah. That's a terrifying word.
It is, right? Well, he's a huge fan of Tony Robbins, and he's been to all his marketing events and like spent like 10 grand and on like the first course, like he's paid for the upsell and blah, blah, blah. And I realized that he always said to me, yeah, but like he helps people. And I'm like, yeah, he helps people, but that's an indirect result of him trying to separate them from their money and put them into an upsell.
Yeah.
Something like a $15,000 course. He's not trying to help them because he wants to help them. He's trying to help them because he wants to be a billionaire. That's Tony Robbins. Like,
I shouldn't interrupt because you're going somewhere interesting.
No, it's cool.
Yeah, well, I as a coach, I see a therapist twice a month. And I can't believe other coaches don't, but that's a different topic there, right? And the reason I see a therapist is there's an expression, you know, who cares for the carer? And I see someone like Tony Robbins, and I've been to quite a lot of therapists before, and you can spot therapists that they don't do it for a bad reason. They probably aren't even aware that they're doing it for that reason, but they become addicted to being important and saving. They become addicted to the feeling of being that person who can help other people. I think Anthony Robbins is hooked on being a savior for people. I mean, of course he makes money. You know, I mean, he makes so much money that I don't even know how much money he makes, but he's rich as hell. But I think he goes to sleep at night hooked on helping, and it's really dangerous in my opinion. And as a coach, I think that's a huge I think coaches got to look out for that. But we'll talk about that if you want later. But the point is that I remember him saying, my goal in life is to end suffering in the world. I'm going to extinguish suffering, and I'm not your guru. you know, and I'm like
yeah.
But the thing is, you know, I looked at him and his wife and his family, and you know, actually, I don't want to get too deeply into this, but his wife's obviously had a lot of surgery. If you watch her, and he is burning himself into, you know, to a crisp basically from the amount of saving he's doing. And I just look at it and I go, dude, it's such an easy trap to fall in, because while you're saving, you never have to look at yourself. You never have to be human while you're helping other people all the time. And I've seen coaches on coaches on coaches on coaches fall into that trap over and over and over again. And I've seen the temptation, which is why, you know, I am, you know, I see a professional, and you know, we chat, and you know, I listen to everybody all the time, and they listen to me. And you know, psychologists in Australia actually have to see a professional if they're going to be a psychologist. Like it's a requirement, and I think that's perfectly makes sense. But my question is, who helps Anthony Robbins?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure diving into a swimming pool of money every day helps him a lot.
Yeah, but does it, dude? I don't know. I know what you're saying.
And again, I want to make it very clear. I don't give a fuck that the dude's making money. I think it's, yeah, you got to get paid. If you're putting out good stuff into the world, you
100%
expect to be. But with Anthony Robbins, it's kind of, dude, it's kind of like almost, you've heard the expression where something turns in on itself. I think it's got to the point now where it just something makes me feel weird when I listen to that guy. It's just weird, like my spider senses start tingling. It's like, something's not right about this. You know what I'm saying?
I'm going to be honest with you. I get that spider tingling when I speak to people who listen to that guy. And you know what's funny, man, about it? Oi, how deep you want to go now?
Let's go. Oh. As I said to you in the last conversation, I've got no problem with the rabbit hole because I live there most of the time.
I've known you for about 10 years. It's about 10 years now, right? It's got to be 10 years, 9 years, right? Yeah. And you came to live in Australia, and I think you were at that time in a bit of an Anthony Robbins phase. and I don't mean this to be mean, man. And, you know, you and I connected probably properly one time, and we were sitting in a car, man, and, you know, no one was around. And, I mean, you're right for me to talk about this.
Yeah, of course, dude.
Yeah, and the thing is, but you're in a different place now because I can see even letting me talk about this. You know, and you said to me, man, I'm struggling a little bit, man. You know, I'm in Australia, I'm on my own, not with my family, my girl, you know, broken up problems. And, you know, and meanwhile, externally, you're a fucking superhero, dude. You just moved to Australia 5-6 years to get your fucking black belt. You're charismatic. You call everyone bro. You know, man, you open a school with, and it's got people within like fucking 1 week. You're in Blitz magazine. Like, you're taking Australia by storm. You remind me of George Lazenby in a weird way. You know, you sat down with me once and we connected properly, man. And you know, obviously we're friends obviously now, you know, for a long time, but a lot of the time I found a lot of our discussions moving apart from each other, and the parts that were moving apart were generally the things where it's about moving forward and being this. And I find Anthony Robbins teaches you how to disconnect from people with NLP and like all that sort of stuff. It's always about being someone different to who you are. You know, you're the person you dream about being. And you know what, man, I spent my entire life trying to grow down and actually just be comfortable being who I am, you know, not being who my dad says I am, who I think I am, who I want to be, who I think I should be, who you know, a girlfriend who dumped me in high school wanted me to be. And I think Anthony Robbins, man, is, you know, it really plays on that, like that void we all have, which is to want to be better than what we are. And man, no matter how hard you struggle, you can't be better than what you are. What you are is great already, but you never get to be you because you're too busy trying to be this fucking weird, you know, rocky road conglomeration. And you know, as you and I've gone on and on, I can see even you've sort of grown away from that stuff, man. But I've seen, yeah, you're a different person to the first guy I met, man. You know, and
yeah,
I met you, this guy I'm speaking to now, I met once while we're sitting in a car in Chatswood. And the rest of the time, it was the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood God. And I don't mean that to be mean. Dude, it's just what it was.
I got to tell you straight up, bro. It's so strange for me to hear you say that you thought I was taking Australia by storm and blah, blah, blah. And like, dude, at that point, I was at the lowest point in my life, dude. Like, I don't want to say I was suicidal, but I was depressed and I couldn't see the light at the end of the tunnel, and I didn't feel like anything was going well in my life. And I guess sometimes what you have to do is, it's kind of like you're looking for something to hold on to. And if that positive thinking mentality was, I remember like my girlfriend at the time, she was like, I think you need to go see a therapist and they need to prescribe you antidepressants. And I was like, no, I'm going to get myself through this on my own. I'm not going to medicate through, which looking back, I'm glad I did. I'm glad I didn't take any medication.
Yeah, but I agree with that part.
I wish someone had just said to me, hey, dude, you know what? Things are difficult. and you feel like shit and you feel lonely and you're afraid, and that's okay. You don't have to wake up every morning and crush it.
Yeah.
You know? Or you don't have to. I wish someone had just taken me aside and said, fuck, bro. Like,
I'm sad I didn't do that for you, man, because I've been in the same place you have, and you know, I've experienced the same things, and I had that opportunity sitting in the car to actually do that, and I'm a bit sad I didn't actually recognize that. But yeah, man, the crushing it. Fuck, dude, I watched Jocko. You know Jocko, that Jocko Willick guy?
Yeah. Oh, dude, it's so cool you brought this up. It's so, yeah, because I've got a lot to say about, man, I really want to talk to that guy.
That guy. I don't take this disrespectfully. I think he's a cool guy. But when he goes, you got to get up at 4:30 in the morning and own the day, attack it aggressively. Do you know what I do at 4:30 in the morning right now besides tell my baby to go back to sleep while he cries? I get up in the morning now and I go back to bed. Go back to bed. It's okay for you to lie in bed today.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to crush it yet. It's only fucking 6 a.m. Let's go back to bed. Yeah. You know what? Don't pick up your phone. Let's go and have breakfast and just don't start working yet. Just give yourself till 10. You know, maybe turn the TV on and relax a little bit. Like, the Jocko guy, I get what he appeals to, man, but I think he's quite dangerous, actually, to be honest. He's extreme ownership. 4:30 in the morning, get their own attack day. I'm like, dude, come on, bro. Yeah. Tell the person to fucking relax.
I'm so glad you brought this up because, again, dude, as with everything else in life, it's a paradox, right? Because sometimes you just have to man the fuck up. Sometimes you have to own your shit and stop crying and realize that you've actually got it really good and you live in a first world country and, you know, you have all your arms and legs and all your faculties and you have a network of friends and...
Yeah, but that never sticks, man. Come on, bro. That sticks for about 5 minutes, you know, when you, like, pump yourself up.
You get what I'm saying, though, right?
Like, I know what you're saying. I'm just teasing.
Sometimes it's not that bad. Sometimes it's just like, fuck it, dude, like... Stop whining, turn off the TV and go fucking make something happen. But I wanted to say to Jocko Willink, I listened to one of his things. He was talking to a buddy and his buddy was, or one of the people in his division or one of the people in his team.
I think the two of us could take him together. I feel like we could.
But he was saying something like, okay, you got a problem? That's good. I want to hear about problems because that means it's an opportunity to solve them, right? And this thing happened to you, good. Just push through it. Or you're gun jammed and there's mud on your weapon and it's raining and you're behind enemy lines, good. That's an opportunity to prove yourself. And I was just thinking like, okay, cool. I get that. That's cool and you got to act like that. But okay, so your daughter just died in a car accident.
Oh yeah. Yeah, good. Get up and run at 4:30.
Get up and fucking push through this motherfucker. Like, no, dude, that stuff doesn't work for all situations. It's a limited tool for dealing with life. It's a limited tool. It's a
stopgap. It
can't solve all problems. Yeah.
It's an effective way, especially in a life and death situation, to act. There's no question about that. You know, but beyond life and death, what happens then? You know?
Yeah. And I think we could bring it back to jiu-jitsu and realize, like, man, it's one of the things I struggled with, dude. I struggle with it because, you know, you're surrounded by this world. Like, I immerse myself in this world of tough guys. Dude, this is a world of people who, because the path for a jiu-jitsu guy is you do jiu-jitsu and then you fight MMA and, like, you know, you get punched in the face or you get kicked or you get slammed or it's like... And you can't show weakness, dude. It's not what's done. You don't show weakness and you're training all the time. And, you know, the whole thing is about, like, the whole thing is like pushing through and like make your body listen to you and dominate and willpower. And like you get exactly what you deserve in this world. And it's this constant like pressure of this, like this very aggressive, very masculine, very, very domineering sort of energy, dude. And I realized one day, like, if you swim in that pool, you can only swim for a finite amount of time before the acid in the pool burns you away.
100%.
Does that make sense?
100%. I mean, how many years do you get to stay in the army for in active service? There's a reason it's not 5 to 20 years.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't have that attitude. Yeah. Just push through. Just ignore it. You know, you can't do that for too long before someone puts a gun to their own head. You know, it's just not. And I don't mean that to be funny. What I've learned, man, from coaching, and I've been coaching now, man, I've been coaching for about 12 years now. And I, I've seen a lot of different people come through my academy, man. Like a lot of different stories, a lot of different people, and as all coaches do, by the way. And I've learned, man, that it always comes out somewhere. So you know, there's a usefulness in a life or death situation with just man up, do it, woman up, whatever you want to call it, woman up, man up, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, you just push through it. This is a chance to prove you. That does work, but at the end of the day, whatever's left inside, when you have a Sunday where your missus is out and there's no one around and no friends to hang out with, or you're asleep at night, it comes out somewhere. And, you know, my friend's a psychologist, and my friend John is a psychologist, and he's, just to give you a credential, he's to give him some weight, which means nothing actually at the end of the day, because that's a different topic. But, you know, he works at one of the premier facilities in the world. It's 30,000 euros a day to stay there for one person. And, you know, I mean, he's cream of the crop. And he uses this great example of, you know, a dad pulls up to school and the kid turns to his dad and he says, "Dad, you know, I'm scared to go to school today." And the dad looks at him and goes, "Listen, son, there's nothing to be scared of. Just, you know, you'll be okay once you're in there." And there's a usefulness to that, man. You know, like, there's a usefulness to that. But the problem is that becomes all parenting and all coaching. And the issue that happens with that is that the son is not being heard by the father. And when the son isn't heard by the father, he'd think there's something wrong with him. And there's more to this example, and I'm not a psychologist, but, you know, I've coached a lot of people, so have you, and, you know, I've coached UFC level fighters, and there are some guys who it's like, "Hey, see that guy outside the cage? Thinks you're a fucking pussy. Get out there and knock him out." And that works. You throw the bone, that fucking pit bull goes and fetches it. But in my experience, when you have a guy who's not a fighter or a girl who's not a fighter, they're a competitor, somebody who's competitive and intelligent, you are actually better off acknowledging that they are scared and that, you know, that they are scared. That's what they are. It's not just suck it up and we're going to get out there and the nerves will disappear. There's a time to say, look, once you're out there, you touch hands, the nerves disappear. That's my experience. But there's another time which is very useful, I find, for myself as an athlete and as a coach, to say, "Man, I hear you're scared, you know, and it is scary. And being scared is part of fighting. And, you know, we have to go through this to get to the other side. What are your values? Do you want to be the guy who didn't walk out, or you want to be the guy who walked out scared and fought?" So when I hear all this shit about, like, you know, fear and da-da-da, it's, man, for me, like, someone brave is someone who has fear and does it anyway. And yeah. I mean, that's corny, like corny shit, but I don't think it's as common as you think. Like, for you, that's common. You're like, "Oh, like, that makes sense." But I don't think people realize how important it is sometimes just to actually hear somebody and acknowledge that they've got fear and doubts. And, you know, I mean, I don't know about you, but I've felt like a fraud no matter how many times my students tell me I'm good and this and that, you know?
I have a couple of stories that I think you might appreciate. I remember I was training with one of my first coaches.
It was a long fortune cookie, by the way.
Sorry. It's a good one, though. One of my first coaches at Rogers Academy was a guy called Felipe. And Felipe was a very cool guy, very much in Rogers' shadow, because he was obviously nowhere near as good, nowhere near as big.
no one as good. Yeah, like, yeah. As of last weekend, there's no one as good. So
exactly. But he's just he was an excellent coach, and, you know, everyone liked him, and he just had a good vibe and just a good dude. And I remember, yeah, to go out on the mat and do jiu-jitsu, it's like the fire is gone. Or, and I think that
he
comes
sucks.
From,
what a shitty coach.
Yeah, what a fucking
weakling,
bro. What a
terrible person. What a terrible human being.
Yeah. And
I hope you quit that day, tore up your membership and threw your patch at him.
but I get that, dude. Everyone you've met, even the top guys, they all go through that kind of point where it's like, goddamn, like, is this it? Am I going to have to be paying my dues every minute of every day, constantly, like, watching my back, constantly, like, being afraid to show vulnerability or being scared of getting tapped out? Or I remember I came to your gym once, the first time I taught there, and you and I trained, we had a good role, and I thought it was fun. And afterwards, you said to me, "Oh, bro, I was thinking, oh, I can't let Nick tap me out." Or like,
did I say that? Oh, Jesus Christ!
You said, and I was just thinking to myself,
"I'm the size of your leg."
But I was thinking to myself, like, damn, bro, I wasn't thinking of trying to beat you. I was just thinking, let's have a cool role, and I just got off the plane, and I want to sweat a little bit, and like, let's have some fun. And I, but here's the thing, I know what you were going through because I've been through that as well, and I still like Rogers Academy, dude. Like, it's very rare for me to.
That place is full of beasts. God damn, dude, I thought it was gonna be flowy Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. That place is a fucking murderer's row, man.
Yeah, dude. Like, for me, like, I have to work myself up to go and train there. I have to literally, like, psych myself up because I know, dude, for whatever reason, these guys are gonna kick the shit out of me, like, no matter what. And it's like, it's not pleasant, bro. It's not, for me, it's not pleasant.
You know, there was this wonderful lady speaking on Tim Ferriss's show, and I can't remember her name. She wrote a book called Mating Captivity and State of Affairs. She's like a European Jewish lady. Her parents were Holocaust survivors, and she talks about monogamy a lot, right? And she talks about monogamy.
I haven't heard that, but another person mentioned this to me, so I'm very interested to hear what you have to say about it.
She's a wonderful lady, man. And she had said a lot of interesting things to say that you could, I'm not going to rehash, but she talked about animals, they have sex, and we have erotica. And erotica wasn't sex for her. Erotica is the place you go when you're with another person. And she described Holocaust survivors that had come over to her parents' community. And there were two types. There were people who survived and people who thrived. And the people who thrived were people who found erotica and intimacy and celebration and everything. The other people closed the windows and they just survived till they died. And it reminded me of jiu-jitsu. And, you know, we were born into it through romance. And she talks a lot about monogamy. And how it's one of those things, it's the few things in the world that are renegotiated constantly. It's a set of rules from 100 years ago that we follow, and this is it. And she said, in order for it to survive, it has to be constantly renegotiated to keep the erotica involved. And she said, you know, erotica's been stolen by the West and it become porn, but for her, it's not even about sex. It's not even related to sex. And the thing with jiu-jitsu is that, unfortunately, it's still very archaic. It's not something that's renegotiated constantly, and our relationship is constantly renegotiated, and the world it sits and renegotiates what jiu-jitsu is to us. It's still the same as what it was 20, 30 years ago. And it doesn't surprise me that you burn out and you feel, you know, sometimes you don't feel like being on the mat, and, you know, people still think that a black belt has to smash everybody. I mean, a judo guy looking at us thinks it's hilarious that tapping matters. A world Olympic champion gets foot swept every 5 seconds by guys who aren't even half as good as him, you know, for Ippon. And this is, you're like, Liam's ranting at snack break. The thing about it is, man, is that I have to renegotiate my relationship with jiu-jitsu all the time, and my relationship with being a coach all the time. It's not, I joined and I do Vale Tudo, and I follow the Gracie family, and I eat acai, and I get on the mat and sweat, and that keeps the doctor away. That's what it was for me for the first 10 years. And then after the first 10 years, the problem was everybody above me and around me was still saying the same slogans from 10 years ago. And I watched my coaches, I watched their masters, I watched the Gracies, I watched everybody burn out. Everybody. I mean, in the time I was in, I've met Master Hoyler, Gracie. I've rolled with him twice, and it was a wonderful experience, by the way. He beat my ass. But besides that, I didn't see... I could see someone like Hoyler, and I've been around Hickson and been to his things. I can see that these guys are burnt out and they feel guilty for it. They don't, they're saying they love jiu-jitsu, but they're struggling with it, and nobody's saying, hey, it's all right if you maybe don't love jiu-jitsu for a couple of weeks and then you come back to it later, you know. Or I watched everybody above me throw the slogans out and suffer the exact same things we all suffer in silence. And nobody's renegotiating these terms, you know, so they swing to the left to self-defense and then to sport, and everyone's Facebook poster, I love jiu-jitsu 5 times a day. You know, who's the guy who's like, man, I went to jiu-jitsu 3 times this week, yeah. You know, like, yeah. Well, went twice, had a good time, didn't enjoy one of them at least, but the second one was great. Like, imagine as a coach I did that, man. I'd lose, everyone would be like, oh, that guy doesn't like jiu-jitsu, fuck him.
Yeah. You said something to me which I want to thank you for it because it helped me so much. You told me about one of your students who I met as well when I was in Australia. Mm. Your buddy Jason Gulati.
Oh, he's amazing, yeah. I hate him, he's so good. And you can't hate him because he's nice, unfortunately.
He's a good dude. And you said to me, he got better faster than anyone else.
100%.
And he only trained 3 times a week.
Correct.
Consistent. Correct. 3 times a week. And that always stuck with me. It always stuck with me because, dude, there's for me now, jiu-jitsu, I don't go if I don't feel like it. Mm. You know, and again, it's a very fine line because if you're a naturally lazy person, then you're never going to go. So I'm not saying that to adopt that mindset, you've got to be smart enough to think through this for yourself. If you need to get in shape and you're lazy, don't adopt that mindset. But if you've been training 6 days a week for the past 10 years and your body's fucked and you're not enjoying yourself and jiu-jitsu is becoming a chore, then you might want to think about adopting that for a while at least. If you don't feel like training, don't train. And then that feeling comes back. He's like, no, I've got a knee injury and I want to train. I'm itching, dude. I want to get on. I can't think of anything better than like going and having a cool role. You know, I want to train, but my knee is fucking jacked. So I know what you mean. Like it's that renegotiation, as you said. That's a very cool way to put it.
Yeah, and I want to make it clear, man, when I was talking about, you know, Hoyler and the guys not getting on the mat, what I think happens is that there's so much pressure on people to be someone and to win and be magical that I think it takes the joy out of it. And I found myself looking around and going, oh, I'm a bit tired today. I don't want to wrestle with my heavy black belt. I'll wrestle with him tomorrow when I'm hydrated. And I'm like, I realize I'd learned that behavior, and I'm not blaming anybody for that. It's my own fault. But, you know, that sort of behavior takes the artistry out of, the creativity out of jiu-jitsu. And the only reason I do jiu-jitsu is to be creative. You know what I mean? And to be an artist. So imagine I said to you, Nick, you know, you can make a film, but it has to be the best film you ever make. Nick, your next instructional video, it has to be the best one. I mean, dude, you'd sit and create nothing. You know, maybe once in a while you'd put something out, but where's the joy in that? And yeah, you know, I caught myself doing that, man, and I forced myself just to, I'm not feeling well. Oh, that doesn't matter, Lawrence, big guy, come over here. And funny enough, of course, Jay Scalati, who's like half my age, said to me, he goes, some weeks I do kickboxing, some weeks I do jiu-jitsu, whatever I feel like. And of course, he's good at everything, which is why I hate him. But, dude, you know, it's... Yeah. You know, I trained 16 times a week at one stage, man. I was doing 16 jiu-jitsu sessions a week, and Jace was whooping my ass. And I was like, what the fuck is going on here? I've got to train more.
Like, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it was exactly a weird pseudo-competency issue. I don't know what it was, man. But yeah, I think everybody needs to be a bit more open about this stuff and not just post how much they love jiu-jitsu all the time. It's all right to say, you know what? I don't like jiu-jitsu today. Yeah, today I woke up and I'm not going to do jiu-jitsu because I didn't like it. I don't feel like it. And I think you're right, man.
Yeah. And ultimately, I think if you start to think about it in this way, you'll actually come to enjoy it a lot more. And you know, it's my fiance, she's very good with this. She's very astute, and she says, it comes back to the Tony Robbins stuff. You can't feel positive and amazing all the time. And sometimes it's just healthy to go, things are shit. Do you know what I mean? Anyway, dude.
You know, man, the thing is, you know, the thing I think is interesting about it as well, though, is, you know, I had to talk to one of my fighters the other day. You know, he's having a little bit of a break. He had surgery. And I think one of the places jiu-jitsu is very useful is to have a certain number of training sessions as non-negotiables. So it's like, you know, like, it doesn't have to be a big number. two times a week, three times a week. And the reason I bring that up is when I've gone through hard things in my life, and I'm sure you've gone through, once you get over 30, it's suddenly it's like, nothing happened before 30. What the fuck is going on? You know, breakups with girls, losing jobs, losing family members, depression. I've been fortunate enough to not have depression, but, I've seen people have depression. And if you set at least a minimum of twice a week is a non-negotiable, right? Because your jiu-jitsu is going to always have plateaus in it. There's no question. I think it can be a very useful tool for getting you out of the house and forcing you to socialize. And I think that's very important, man. As a mental health tool, it's good to have at least one or two a week as non-negotiables in terms of particularly if you're prone to, say, like anxiety or depression or something like that.
I completely agree with you. You know, I think that's fantastic advice, Liam. That's really good advice.
I can feel we're getting to the end of this.
No, it's cool. I mean, for me, I'm on three times a week, non-negotiable.
That's perfect, dude. That's perfect. Yeah. You know, and the thing is, three good sessions a week is way better than 16 mediocre sessions, man. But, you know, I don't think the jiu-jitsu world is honest with itself at the moment. And I think there's a lot of people suffering in silence. And I hope in hearing this, they also understand this is not just Nick and Liam talking. I've spoken to Marcelo Garcia about this. I've spoken to the Mendez brothers about this. I've spoken to UFC champions about this. I've spoken to Greg Jackson about this. I mean, I saw Greg Jackson burnt out one day, and I was like, holy shit, this is the guy I want to be? I mean, he's a legend. It could be worse than Greg Jackson. He's a really nice guy. But, man, I watched him really genuinely burnt out. And
how was that characterized when you say he was burnt out?
You know, man, I was like, man, this is great, and Greg Jackson's the top guy. He's the guy we look at to model on. You know, Greg Jackson has kids and a business that he can't attend to as well because he's got success. And, he's just supposed to be Greg Jackson all the time. So sometimes, man, I realize I'm happy I skipped the fame boat there, or I'm happy I flew under the radar a little bit, because you get to choose your own terms. You know, success that we're all going for brings a certain amount of pressure and expectations that take, your life's control out of your hands. Mm-hmm. So, you've got a fair amount of success yourself. Do you find that, you know, that sort of pressure on to be somebody that you're not necessarily exactly who you wanted to be?
Oh yeah, bro, without question. I mean, anytime. No, dude, without question.
And just your brotherhood's taken over.
One of the best ways to just deal with that kind of stuff is to just accept your shortcomings and work on them as best as you can. But you know that there's that track. It's I don't know what the name of it is, but I absolutely love when it comes on. It's that I'm only human after all, or something like that. But it came on yesterday, and I was thinking about it. Fuck, dude, yeah, I'm only human. Sometimes I'm supposed to feel shit. I'm not supposed to feel like a robot, like cyborg, amazing, top of the world, master of the universe all the time. Sometimes I just want to fucking curl up into a little ball and cry myself to sleep, dude. But
well, dude, I'm glad to hear that, because your profile picture looks like the fucking James Bond, Craig Jones. What's his name? Not Craig Jones, Daniel Craig or something like that. Dude, people look at you and they're like, this guy has a deep voice. He's a big black belt guy. He's got a good business. He's, you know, a good looking dude. He's, blah, blah. I mean, people look at you and they, I'm so glad you're doing this podcast.
Thanks, bro.
I'm so glad you're doing it. So people can actually hear that. Even Nick, let's call you Gabriel. I've known you for so long, I can't pronounce your last name. Gregory Artis.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Nick, because I remember you changed it to Gabriel for a little while, just to make it easy for idiots like me.
But remember, everyone's Facebook thing looks like that, though, dude. Everyone's Facebook and Instagram is a cultivated collection of their very, very, very best moments from the very, very best angles, and it's artificial. It's a fake reality.
Do you ever try to put it out there that, do you ever, like, you know, man, someone asked me the other day with my kid, he goes, you know, you're going to be your kids, you want to be your kid's hero? And I said, man, I'm going to let my kids see the sores early, save them the disappointment so that we can get on with the real stuff, you know?
Yeah, that's a good one. No, let me put it out there once and for all. I'm as much of a failure as I am of a success. And just like everyone else, dude, just like every other human being on the planet. And I guess the best thing to do is just accept that and learn to live with it.
I feel like someone like yourself is your success is a part is probably makes it actually harder for you than the average person, to be honest. You know, so that probably puts a bit of a weight on your shoulder, man. That I don't think people realize that is actually there's like a paradoxical effect of, you know, how you appear and how successful you appear with how you kind of see yourself. So I'm glad to hear that you're dealing. I mean, you do the work, man, and that's important, you know. And yeah, I sometimes feel sorry for the celebrities that don't get to be who they actually are. Have you ever watched that George Lazenby documentary? And he gave up the James Bond after one time.
No shit, because he just didn't enjoy the fame or what?
Well, so he got offered $1 million under the table and 6-picture deal. I mean, this guy lied his way into this thing, was having a good time. And he just basically went on a bunch of talk shows and says, I'm not James Bond. Stop fucking treating me like James Bond. No one's James Bond. I'm George Lazenby. I'm a friggin' mechanic / car salesman. The guy goes, you want to be a used car salesman or James Bond? He goes, I'll be all right with being a used car salesman.
Wow.
And I was like, dude, I went to bed smiling last night. I thought it was hilarious. Cool. Yeah, man. Everyone makes a joke of the guy, but fuck, I respect that dude. He could have gone the other way, and he just chose to do his own thing.
Liam, my brother, now that we have head fucked the entire jiu-jitsu population, I want to thank you for.
Yeah, I don't know what this was about, dude. I think next time, I think the one early in the morning, I probably appeared slightly more sane, but I'm not too concerned.
So, my brother,
hopefully that's useful
honesty.
To people,
I really
man.
Appreciate your honesty, and I want to. Just ask you if people want to come or if people find themselves in Sydney and they want to come to your amazing academy and hang out with you and do some jiu-jitsu with you, where can they find out more?
Yeah, man. So look, if you go to vt1mma.com.au, you can find our academy. You know, I run it with my brother Dylan. He's a world Muay Thai champ. And, you know, if you want to come to a place with really good martial arts, really good people and really bad jokes, lots of 80s references, my academy is the place to be. You know, man, look, we've got an open door policy, man. And, you know, I think that's the way it's supposed to be. So hopefully you'll come visit sometime soon, man. It's been 10 years, almost 9 years.
Sure, bro. I've got a tour of Australia next year and I'll stop by for
sure. Yeah, we'll have man. Okay. Yeah, we've had Kit Dale and now we need his better half.
My brother, 1,000 blessings on you and your family and keep the faith, yeah?
Thanks. Lekker brew. See you, man. Appreciate it.
Damn, that was pretty deep. Liam, he really thinks about things a lot and I love the way he's so honest with himself and with others. Hope you guys enjoyed that show as much as I did. I couldn't believe that hour just flew by so quickly. Guys, please remember that you can always support Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood and what we do, including this podcast, by purchasing stuff from our store. If you head on over to store.jiu-jitsubrotherhood.com and you use the code PODCAST, you can get 10% off any of our awesome belts, rash guards, hoodies, t-shirts, jiu-jitsu gis, and instructional materials. And also, I don't often promote products that aren't my own, but I was approached by some guys called Butcher Box recently. What they do is they ship grass-fed meat direct to your door, and they sent me a sample, and I was very, very impressed. Grass-fed or organic and free-range meat is something I think is really, really important. It's something I believe in. I think factory-farm meat is not only really bad for your health, but it's also just morally reprehensible the way meat is created in that system. And I think when you support things like Butcher Box, not only do you get better tasting meat that's better for you, you're also doing the right thing. And the guys at Butcher Box have given us a promo code for you to all use. It's JJB15. It'll get you $15 off your first order with them and a free order of their organic bacon. Trust me, this stuff is delicious and healthy. Check it out. Until next time, thanks for listening to the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood podcast.